And hello and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, March 29th, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Eleanor Lippman and Marcia Clark. First up is Eleanor Lippman. Eleanor is the author of 10 novels, including Isabel's Bed and View from Penthouse B, which she last came on the show to talk about, I believe. She's published a collection of essays and has had not one, but two essays published in the coveted Modern Love column of the New York Times. She's won the New England Book Award and the Patterson Fiction Prize. She's been a judge for the National Book Award. She's here today to talk about her new novel, On Turpentine Road. Hi, Eleanor.
Hello. Hello. It's actually On Turpentine Lane.
On Turpentine Lane. There you go.
Close enough.
A road, a lane.
Hey. Right. Ways would get you there, I'm sure, with either.
Well, you know, I wanted to start with a New York Times review, a little snippet from a review of On Turpentine Lane that came out back in February. And the reviewer said, light and tight, On Turpentine Lane is constructed with an almost scary mastery. Not a single thread dangles. Not a single character is left without a place in Faith's world. The story folds out and back in as neatly as an origami flower, and Faith recounts it all with a raised eyebrow and plenty of cheek. I think that is so wonderful.
I do too. I do. I hope. I think first reaction was, of course, may that be on paperback editions and future books. I love that. Thank you for picking that one out.
So I was curious, well, before we get into Faith and more about the book, if you could begin by talking a little bit about On Turpentine Lane and how the book came about.
Sure. The title character is the house itself, 10 Turpentine Lane, and it started off as what I thought I was going to write an essay about a house on the street where I lived for the first 12 years of my life in Lowell, Massachusetts, this little bungalow. And up the street was a house that the kids, and especially my sister and I, considered to be haunted. The woman who lived there was widowed and scary, and she was reclusive and a hoarder. You know, newspapers piled up in the windows. It was all black shingled and overgrown, everything. Then, decades later, I found out that a friend of mine, my best friend in the neighborhood, had bought that house when she was about 60, my friend. And I was so flabbergasted. So I arranged to go with an essay in mind and visit the house and see it in its presumably, you know, better new state. And, you know, essays just sometimes don't work out in terms of just what was the arc of that essay, you know, as I like to say, couldn't get the car into the garage. So I just thought, I'll start there, not a haunted-like house, but a house with a past, and that my narrator, Faith, buys it, she can afford it, and then the story unfolded, which is why, as much as I adore the line about the scary mastery, I don't plot or outline. So I do take it, you know, one sentence at a time, really. So it just unfolded. I sit down every day and think, okay, what next? Now what? Now what? Now what does she do?
So does the plot then emerge from character? Did the plot of this book emerge from Faith? Did she come first?
Yes, I would say. Well, first the house.
The house.
And the other books have happened this way, where I start with a line and then I think, who said that? You know, who's in this little dilemma? And so Faith grew. I got to know her, and then I go back and enlarge or contain or describe or whatever is needed. So I'm discovering Faith myself, and at the same time I'm thinking, you know, I always want to be, well, I always quote, I'm sure I did last time I talked to you, I always quote Elmore Leonard's famous line about, I try to leave out the parts that people skip.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really, I sit down in the morning and then I think, okay, what next? Now what happens? And if I think it needs a little, you know, a little buzz, a little something more exciting than I wrote the day before, then I just kind of work on that. But definitely, faith was just practically a name when I started. And then, you know, I have to then decide, how old is she? What did she do before this? What does she do now? What's her job? So none of that, you know, I'm not one of those authors who has 50 post-it notes up on the bulletin board in front of her. It's, you know, no, discover as I go along.
So how did Faith become a fundraiser for her alma mater?
Oh, I love that question because I was at some event in Boston and somebody was telling me about a job, and there was one at Brandeis and one at Harvard, and it's at some place it's called Director of Stewardship, and what it means is you write thank you notes to those donors, maybe they funded a scholarship in a loved one's name, then you write and tell them how the holder of the scholarship is doing in class or, you know, on the playing field. And I immediately, without having started this book, thought, well, I am surely going to give that job to a character of mine, someone who writes thank you notes for a living, and then she does a little, that's about two-thirds of the job, and then she does fundraising for the annual fund.
Interesting. And I also wanted to ask you about, and if our listeners haven't read the book yet, they won't know what I'm talking about. That's okay. But I wanted to ask you about the album of baby pictures that she finds in her attic and where that came from.
You know, that came because when I thought I was writing an essay and I spoke with my friend who bought the house, and then she put me in touch. I found what would be the granddaughter of this woman who's had been put into foster care, you know, but I found her. And she told me that when the house, she inherited the house before it sold to my friend, and diaries and journals, and there was some kind of fishy, more than fishy, something that there were many children born that this reclusive hermit, scary woman, had siblings born after her who didn't survive in ways that kind of cast doubts or guilt on her. So, let me just say that the whole idea of possible babies that might not have survived, that's where that came from. But then don't forget, it's a Lippman novel, so nothing to, you know, it's, I don't kill people's babies.
Well, speaking of it being a Lippman novel, I recall the last time you were on, you said something to the effect of your readers like your voice. Do you remember that?
Did I say that? Yeah. Sounds a little vain. Did I say that?
Well, I think we were talking about, just the charming quality, the something. I don't know. I haven't listened to the show, so I don't know exactly what we were talking about. But I remember you saying, you know, I don't think we were talking about brand even, but, you know, that readers look forward to a certain something when they come to your books.
Well, I think, you know, what I'm told and people say, and especially I did a pretty big book tour for this book, and one thing that it was so gratifying, it was, and now this is my 11th novel, and so people would come up and have it signed, and so often give me a testimonial about what the books meant to them, and often some woman said, I lost my husband, you know, in 2009, she told me, and your books and Frasier saved me. And another woman in Cambridge, and it was so touching, she told me she just that day been to the doctor, second recurrence of cancer, she was dying, and meeting me was on her bucket list. And that had to do with she said, even that day, reading this book, she was laughing. So That means everything to me. That, yes. So I think when I say voice, is that people appreciate a book that makes them laugh, that is at the same time, you know, a well-written book, a book that's considered a literary book, but literary but funny.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about your dialogue because you write a lot of it, and I love the quote on the front of On Turpentine Lane that was in People magazine. Lippman is a diva of dialogue. Her repartee flashes like Zorro's sword. And it's true. It's you write a lot of it, and I love that. And, you know, sometimes I've heard writers talk about how, you know, you don't want dialogue to do more than just the heavy lifting. And I think your dialogue does a whole lot more than that. Talk about dialogue and your relationship to it.
I will. Thank you. Dialogue is the easiest part for me. I have to make sure I'm not doing it too early, too late. Then I follow, it was David Mamet quoting William Goldman, the screenwriter, saying, get into a scene as late as possible and out of it as early as possible. So I don't include the hello, how are you, or crossing the threshold, or have a seat. So I feel that dialogue cannot be just for the sake of dialogue, that it has to be in some way either characterizing who's speaking, helping to characterize, or in some way moving the story along. So that's why I'm taking out the hello and the how are you and, you know, do you want a cup of coffee, unless somehow offering a cup of coffee is saying something about the manners or hospitality of the person we haven't met who maybe is a little nervous, and I try to get that across and try to do it within the dialogue and not use adverbs to say, you know, spoke, said that wittily, said that sarcastically, said that sharply, that I try to put that in the dialogue. And so that, though, is still easier for me. I have to push myself to do description and say, what does it look like? Mm-hmm. And not a lot, never reaching to be poetic with, you know, what is opening. I don't open any chapters with a description of the weather because I've judged those short stories and novels where every chapter literally opens with a description of the sky or the weather. And so I just want the salient details and move things along.
Hmm. Well, I would love to hear you read from On Turpentine Lane. Would you do that?
I will. Okay. I will. Just a couple of minutes.
Yep.
I'm starting with a chapter two. Faith is engaged as the book opens. My fiancé was out of town for an indefinite period because he was walking across the continental United States. His purported goal was not necessarily the Pacific Ocean, but finding his own path in life. It wasn't just his mission statement, but how he talked, on the road or off, raising consciousness, searching for awesomeness in the everyday. People often look perplexed when I try to explain Stuart's expedition or what I saw in him. There was a time during the period I call Stuart 1.0 when his Instagrams almost exclusively chronicled our dates and were followed by a festival of hashtags expressing affection and devotion. There was a thoughtfulness that I saw as a predictor of husbandly attentiveness. There was a full-time job with the Mass Department of Transitional Assistance that paid for the tickets and trinkets he hid rather adorably around my apartment. But he changed, and overnight isn't an exaggeration. He started using words such as potentiality and wholeness after an emergency appendectomy. He emerged from his hospital stay a different man. It wasn't organic or neurological, but social, a rebirth inspired by the free soul in the next bed, whose worldview sounded good to Stuart, post-surgically, supine, and dangerously close to turning 40. I gave it some time, accepting the new, softer, vegetarian Stuart 2.0. When friends heard about his walk and asked me if he was a nonconformist or a nut, I told them this was just a new lifelong goal, to find himself by crossing the country on foot, a sabbatical of sorts. I agreed to be one of his sponsors in the form of a jointly held credit card, which he vowed to use sparingly, if at all. His quest sounded sincere, his embrace of everything and everybody, whether it was scenery or wildlife, or the people who offered him a couch, an indoor shower, a sandwich. I was skeptical that his lightweight cause would attract the goodwill and hospitality needed. But sure enough, thanks to coverage by local TV stations, big-hearted families stopped their cars to ask what they could do. Mm. He wore a sign that said, "In Search of Stories" on one side, and when flipped, "Free Hugs" in Spanish and English. At last count, he'd slept in 3 unlocked churches, 1 synagogue, 1 mosque, a few shelters, and several fraternity houses. Because he believed it's dangerous to text while walking, he checked in less frequently than I liked. We talked several times a week unless his battery was dead or he'd had too much to drink, which happened while staying with frat boys, current or emeritus. When challenged about what was looking to me like debauchery, he said what he'd look like to his hosts was judgmental if he didn't partake. And wasn't the whole journey about walking 2 moons in another man's moccasins? I was 32. I wasn't getting any younger. I said, yes, I suppose so.
Mm. Thank you. That was Eleanor Lippman reading from On Turpentine Lane, published by Harcourt, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You know, I just sort of what we were talking about a little while ago about the readers that come up to you, that have come up to you at events. Are you ever thinking, when you're writing, are you thinking about readers or marketing? And if not, how do you keep that out of your office?
You know, I don't, I mean, those testimonials wash back. You know, there was another one, and it had to do with her mother had cancer. She put her in a room off the living room. She was dying. She was in pain. And she gave her Isabel's Bed, my third novel, and could hear her laughing. So, of course, I didn't have to try to memorize that. It just means so much to me. But I don't, you know, as much as I recall those and savor those, I don't. I have 2 readers, and they are the wonderful biographer Stacy Schiff, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Cleopatra and Vera and The Witches. She was my editor when she was 25 years old, my first editor, and a wonderful novelist, Mamie Medwed. And I give them I give them chapters as I write them, so I revise and revise and polish. So I'm really thinking of them when I write, and then, you know, sort of the overall concern about, will my editor like this? Will my agent like this? Will Houghton Mifflin want to publish this? But really, I really have both feet in the work. And I don't think about the marketing or even the sales, and people think it's funny. I have author friends who say, "How's it selling?" And I say, I don't ask. if it's good news, such as we went back to press, it comes to you. And I've had, this is the 11th novel, but it's the 14th book, and I learn what is going to keep me going merrily along versus, you know, who needs a little kick in the pants.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And you also do not have an MFA.
And correct.
I am so curious what you think about the MFA, what shall we call it? I want to say the MFA factory, but that's not very nice, and I don't mean to be mean. I'm just, you know, it's such a big deal these days, and so many writers are concerned that if they don't have them, what is that going to mean? Will they still get published? Any thoughts?
Oh, well, I'm living proof that you don't need an MFA. I think there was a time where an MFA, and I mean a long time ago, where an MFA could get you a teaching job to teach fiction or nonfiction or poetry at an institution of higher learning. But there are millions, I think, of people, hundreds of thousands, coming out every year with an MFA. I was about to apply when, way back, it had to be 30-plus years ago, when I was about to apply, and one of my stories, I'd only had two stories published, but it was chosen for an anthology. And I thought, you know, maybe this is working out okay, plus at the same time, I got an agent. So I would say, I don't know many agents, I don't know any agents who would say, well, you know, love this work, love this novel, love this proposal for your brilliant nonfiction book, but you don't have an MFA. I think it's great if you can afford the time and the money. It gives you those 2 years, or on a part-time basis, maybe more, time to write and feedback. But I don't think it's a guarantee of anything. And I one of the most helpful things, I was once on a panel with my very own editor, wonderful editor named Jane Rosenman, who now does freelance editing, and someone raised their hand in the audience and said, now what are you looking for? Is it, you know, science fiction? Is it, at that time there was, you know, books on submarines, and the person listed a whole bunch of the genre things and, you know, romance of that. And she listened and nodded, and then she said, I'm looking to fall in love on the first page.
Mm. Yeah, that first page.
Yeah. Important, very important.
How much do you work on your first page at this point?
Oh, God. Well, see, I'm stumbling. A lot. I mean, to me, it's partially is Jane's statement, but I feel it's the most important page. The ending, of course, is right up there in terms of exceedingly important. I want my readers to be satisfied, but yes, of course, I work on every word. And my first chapters tend to be short, which I can, I can get away with that. You can get away with that. Anyone can get away with that. But I think it has to be sharp and vivid. And I also try to follow the advice. Henry James talked about weak specification. So not to do that. So weak specification is when you just have a series of prepositional phrases. He walked out the door, down the street, into the car. Boring, eyes glaze over. That I'm always trying to give the text texture. So instead of just saying, water the plant, it might be water the Diefenbachia or the split leaf philodendron.
Mm-hmm.
So texture and no weak specification.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great note to go out on, because those first pages can just wreak havoc with a person's life and with a writer's life.
Just keep, as my old writing teacher used to say, this was an adult ed course at Brandeis, just when people thought it was done, he'd say, run it through the typewriter one more time. This is when it was, typewriter. And it really does. You run it through the typewriter one more time. You get a feel for the little weaknesses and how to strengthen it. And you almost always improve it.
Mm. So true. Eleanor, this half hour has just vaulted by. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. And yes, and hello to Irvine. I'll be out there soon. My son moved to Los Angeles, and I'm visiting next month.
Oh, let us know.
And be heading through it, heading down to Laguna for someone's birthday party.
That sounds great.
Anyway, so thank you, and regards to Marcia Clark, please.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay. Thank you, Barbara.
Bye. That was Eleanor Lippman. Her new novel is on Turpentine Lane. Wonderful. Loved it. And wow, she's coming through. Maybe we should get her at the speaker series. Anyway, stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute with Marcia Clark. Don't go away.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you turns my whole just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you,
just the thought,
my love, my whole.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. We're also on iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I was on the first half with Eleanor Lippman, author of On Turpentine Lane, and I'm back with Marcia Clark. Marcia is the author of 6 best-selling legal thrillers, a practicing criminal lawyer since 1979. She joined the LA District Attorney's Office in 1981, where she served as prosecutor for the trials of Robert Bardo, convicted of killing actress Rebecca Schaefer, and most notably O.J. Simpson. She recently released her 1997 number one New York Times bestselling book on the trial, Without a Doubt, as an ebook with a new foreword. She's here today to primarily talk about her most recent series, which includes Blood Defense and Moral Defense, featuring criminal defense attorney Samantha Brinkman. The third book in the series, Snap Judgment, will be released in August 2017. Welcome, Marcia.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to have you. I want to say, first of all, that the OJ trial began shortly after my son Travis was born, and we spent the first weeks of his life watching the trial. Well, he slept mostly, but
lucky you.
But
my
oldest
son is Travis too.
Yeah, I know. We both have sons named Travis, so it's wonderful for many reasons to have you here today. Let's begin with you talking about a bit about your most recent series, Blood Defense and Moral Defense, and how that series came about.
It was weird because I had finished writing my first series, Rachel Knight, which is based on a prosecutor. And after the fourth book, I thought, you know, I'd like to do a standalone. That's what I'd really like to do. So I sat down to think about standalones, and I took a pass at one, two, three, and they just weren't getting right. And then after the third effort, and a couple of those went almost as full book length. I mean, it was really a lot of work. And by the third one, I still didn't have it right. And then in a fit of despair, Samantha Brinkman showed up just kind of there. And I thought, oh, I know what I'm going to write now. And I guess so much for writing a standalone, I went for another series. And she's this wonderfully kind of twisted, tough, but funny, but very edgy character, much edgier than Rachel Knight. And it's really been a blast writing someone who has no rules and no boundaries, and her heart's in the right place, but she kind of goes a lot farther than anybody else would even think of going to make the right thing happen. So she's been a lot of fun.
And the first series, the character, your protagonist was a prosecutor.
Yes.
And so in this one, she's a defense attorney.
Right.
So that has to be different.
Way different. And because she is the kind of, Samantha is the kind of no boundaries, no rules. Basically, she loves giving a middle finger to the system. That's her favorite thing to do. she's defending people, and she pulls out all the stops to defend them. And I get to tell about legal practice from a completely different point of view, not to mention a very twisted point of view. So all the ways that she knows how to work the system, work prosecutors, work judges, and just in general, kind of flaunt authority in every way, shape, and form. It's been a really fun and different way to look at things. And, of course, looking at things from the defense side gives you a chance to talk about the humanity of defendants and that they're not all Hannibal Lecter by any stretch of the imagination. Most of them wind up in prison because of a lack of impulse control, basically. And they're more schlemiels and schlemazels than they are evildoers. And a lot of them given a chance to rehabilitate will. Mm-hmm. So it does give me a chance to talk about that side of things.
Interesting. I read in an interview, and I wish I could remember where I read it, but that it was really the not guilty verdict of the OJ trial that sort of sent you into becoming a writer of novels. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, not directly. But when at the end of that trial, I had just had it. I walked out the day of the verdict, and I never went back. And then I did a number of different things. I did some hosting jobs on cable and a lot of commentary on cable. And then I did behind-the-scenes work in Hollywood. And then I wound up on a television show for Lifetime called For the People, which was a scripted drama, one-hour drama about the DA's office. And that's what got me started writing scripts. And from writing scripts, then that's what kind of gave me the impetus to go back and realize a childhood dream, which was to write crime fiction.
So talk a little bit about writing scripts. I think you worked on some pilots.
Yeah, I did.
So what was the difference for you?
A number of them with a partner Catherine Lepard. We wrote scripts, pilot scripts for FX, VH1, Lifetime, and a comedy treatment for NBC. Then I wound up co-writing a pilot based on the Rachel Knight series for TNT. And most recently, co-wrote with Liz Craft and Sarah Fain, two great showrunners, the pilot based on Blood Defense, based on Samantha Brinkman.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. It's going to be a show?
Well, not in the moment, but another show may be happening. So, mm-hmm. to be TBD, as they say.
So, law is a profession where writing is vital. It seems lawyers, more than many other professionals, become writers. So for you, what was the crossover from law to fiction? I mean, what did you bring other than the obvious sort of, you know, how the law works? But
well, also it's the experience of everything, every case you've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I bring in the experience of the witnesses that I've met and the defense attorneys I've met, the prosecutors I've known, the judges I've known, the defendants, of course, you know, that I've known. So it's all of that. It's all of the life experience you gain by prosecuting and defending cases, because I did both. I was a defense attorney before I became a prosecutor, and now I handle criminal appeals for the indigent, a court-appointed appeal, so I'm back on the defense side again. So it's all of the life experiences from those people that you meet. Knowing how the law works is helpful, because there's a certain amount I don't have to research.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a better time for the reader or the watching audience, no matter what the medium, when they get a sense that things are authentic, when there's an authenticity in the way that you deliver these stories, and when you try to accommodate, when you make an effort to accommodate what's true and what would really happen, you have to be more creative in order to make a drama work. But I think that makes for a much better product, and I think the audience can feel when they're getting something that's more authentic.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. If you just tuned in, you're a little bit late. I am with Marcia Clark. Her new novels are Blood Defense and Moral Defense. And if you are tuning in late, this show, along with hundreds of others, will be podcasts in the next week or so. If you go to penonfire.com, you will see the podcast when it's podcast, or you can go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, and when it's podcast, it will arrive in your inbox. So, Samantha Brinkman, you had your character, and then what? Do you work on outlines? Do you work on plotting? Do you sort of develop the character and see what she brings to the table? How does that go for you?
I always develop from the character out. So the most important thing, like Samantha came to me, it was one of those weird, she just kind of appeared. And then I had to go back and figure out, well, how did you get here? How did you wind up being this person? And so I had to create her entire backstory. Who was she born to? Who was her mom? Who was her dad? Who was her everything? And in her case, the identity of her father is part of her mystery.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't know who he is. Or she didn't know who he was. And the nature of her mother and the complications of who she is and what she, her actions, how they impacted on Samantha and her best friend and all that. So I built out a world for her and then started to think about, okay, this is her world. She was a public defender for a few years, but she only did that to get experience because she's not a team player and she doesn't like being part of a big organization. And she went out and hung out her shingle and hired her best friend to be the paralegal, business manager, office manager, everything for her. And she has this little office. In Blood Defense, she starts out with this office close to the Van Nuys courthouse, which is also happens to be in gang territory. And that's why it was so cheap. So I just kind of built out her world that way. And she winds up hiring a client who'd been busted for hacking to become her investigator. Because he was a lot better than any of the investigators she'd had, and she went through quite a few because she's kind of a tough taskmaster. She's a perfectionist, and she's very smart, and she needed an investigator who could be as fast as she is. And so in Alex, she found that person. With that world in mind, then I think about, okay, how do I reveal more about the character? And I think about a story that can tell you, let her develop. you know, in layers, a little bit here, a little bit there. And the same thing in moral defense. Again, I pick a story. I try to pick stories that have some kind of social relevance as well. Mm-hmm. And more I'm going in that direction. So in moral defense, I chose a protagonist for the crime story who was an adopted girl, winds up getting charged with murder, and explore all of the things that entailed in terms of that character. In Snap Judgment, I actually look into the world of revenge porn and of human trafficking.
Hmm. Well, these are big books. These last two are sitting here in front of me, and I am so curious how you keep everything straight. The books have complicated plots, and so how do you keep it all in line? How do you stay organized and know what happened and what's going to happen? How does that work for you?
I outline. I don't know how anybody could write a murder mystery without outlining, because the whole fun of a murder mystery is to drop little clues along the way. If you don't know where you're going, I don't know how you do that in any kind of organized fashion, and you can't really create a plot with any kind of complexity if you don't know where you're going. Either that, or you write by the seat of your pants, and then you go back and you use some really heavy editing. But I'd rather not do that. So I do outline, and I do an overall synopsis of the story the way I think it should go in just a few pages. And then I break it out into a chapter-by-chapter outline, which is like one or two lines per chapter talking, okay, this is a... And I do... Each chapter is like a scene. This is where script writing really affected me, because in writing scripts for television, you have to do outlines. You must do an outline that the network gets to approve, and then you go to what we call a beat sheet,
mm-hmm.
where you lay out the action beat by beat in each scene, in each act, and then you go to script. And that makes going to script, or in this case, going to book, much more fun and much easier, because the action's laid out for you, so you can just relax into the scene and, you know, and invest it with as much layering and complexity as you like, because you're not worried about where you're going next. So it's kind of a multi-step process, but I like it. It works for me. It doesn't necessarily mean it's not the length of the book that makes that kind of process necessary for me. It's that I want to make sure that I'm not dropping threads, or I'm answering all of the questions that I intend to answer. I don't necessarily intend to answer every single question. There comes a point, I think, after which explaining gets obnoxious,
mm-hmm.
and the reader should be given the grace to, given the credit for being able to put two and two together in some instances. But the big questions, I definitely want to make sure I answer in a satisfying way.
So how long might you spend on doing the synopsis and chapter outline?
That takes me... typically, that goes somewhere between 3 to 4 weeks,
mm-hmm.
sometimes longer, because just conceiving of the story and the issues I want to address, that can take a couple of weeks in and of itself. And then writing, getting the chapter outline, the chapter breakdown done, that's another 2 weeks to get it right.
So, you know, I mean, I think that's great, because what I hear a lot of is writers are very impatient, and you know, we're impatient to write, we're impatient to publish, and outlines and really thinking through a story would really take a lot of patience.
Yes, and I'm not a patient person, I have to admit. I get frustrated with the process every single time. I mean, I'm on my eighth novel, and I mean, just I'm at the point of conceiving of the next story, and I'm just like irritated with myself that it's taking me so long to do, and why do I have to do it like this? I mean, while I'm going through this process that I set up, I'm pissed at myself.
Yeah, but it's working, and and it makes sense with the mystery or thriller genre that you do it that way, because, as you said, there's all sorts of things, all sorts of clues that have to go into the story, and you have to make sure they pay off.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I love in Blood Defense, almost to the end, there was a line that I recalled hearing in the O.J. case. And it was, your protagonist says to her client and father, when I told you that Jenny was dead, you didn't ask me how she died. You said who killed her.
Uh-huh.
And I read that, and I remember saying to my husband, I know I've heard this before. And then, of course, I looked it up, and you're talking about this as an Easter egg.
Yeah.
And I love that. I just love that it was there. Will you talk about that, about Easter eggs, for those who don't know what they are?
Yeah, that's a term I learned in Hollywood. And it's a little hidden gem that's a reference to something else, whether it's within the series or an outside event, but something to do with the story and something that people who care to think about a little deeper will recognize. So it's a little fun thing. It's not necessary for you to know the reference, but it's a kind of fun thing, like you discovered the aha moment can be really a blast, and I love them whenever I catch them. So I threw that one in because I thought that was something that did happen in the Simpson trial, and it was a very telling response by Simpson when he was called by the police. He was in Chicago. And his first question is, who killed her? I mean, who says that? When you hear that your spouse has died suddenly, you think car accident, maybe. Or, you know, you think some kind of falling down the stairs.
Right, right.
You don't think somebody killed her. So it was a fun thing to be able to put in the book. For those who know, they, you know, like yourself, you can enjoy that little fun little find.
Yeah, that was great. That was great. So you published with Amazon.
I did.
How is that?
I love it. I love it.
Tell me about that.
So I didn't know. After I finished with Rachel Knight, I really felt like, you know, new authors need a different kind of support. It's a very crowded field. You have people who are so well established for many, many years. And the readers are going to keep going back to those same names every single time. So you have to entice them somehow into coming to a new author, because it's not just an investment of money, it's also an investment of time. It takes a while to read a book. People want to be sure they're going to get a certain kind of level of fun ride, and they're very reluctant to take a chance. I can identify because I felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to have some means of making it easy for them and making them say, hey, what the hell, I'll try. Amazon is wonderful because, number one, they will price you at a place that makes it easy for people to take a shot. Number two, they make the ebook so accessible and so easy to get, and all of them, really, the paperback and hardcover too. But if you don't want that, you know, the physical book, you get the ebook immediately, and it's so easy with a one-click order. They show you synopses and they show you reader reviews, which I think are much more relevant ultimately, and not in the specific. Any specific reader is going to have a bent that you don't share, that you don't necessarily agree with. But if you look at the overall, you know, blend of reviews, you're going to get a better sense of a book than generally you do with the professional critics who, I'm sorry, I know they're going to, you know, if anybody cares, any of those critics care what I think, they, I very seldom agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people have had that experience where they go, you thought this was great, or you didn't like this book, and just wonder, why am I reading you? Amazon doesn't require, lets you kind of freeze people from that and lets them see what regular people think of a book, and that tends to be, at least for me, much more relevant in terms of whether I'm going to like it or not. These are all very helpful things, ways in which Amazon makes new writers accessible to the public, and I think that's they're terrific about marketing. They're amazing about that. Really know how to reach through the market to in all kinds of different ways, and they're creative about it too. So I've been, and they're very collaborative, but they're also a very well-oiled machine. They don't mess around. You know, they want their books within 1 year. Whereas a lot of the regular publishers, a book a year is all they can manage, and a year and a half can easily go by before the next book is published. Amazon doesn't do that.
Mm.
They get their books out quickly, and I think in this day and age with the digital streaming and everything that is so on demand and so immediate gratification oriented, it's important to get things out to the readers more quickly, and I think Amazon has their finger on that pulse point.
Mm. Yeah, there's so many things to take your attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are you reading fiction as you write?
Yes, I'm not worried about that. I know some writers say that they're worried about being influenced by what they write, by what they read. And I hope I'm influenced by what I read, because I hope I'm always getting better. But I read all kinds of fiction for the purpose of teaching myself and learning what works as well as what doesn't. Sometimes you learn more from something that doesn't work than something that does. Like, I can never write like Stephen King, but I can try and learn the lessons of what makes his writing good. But I'm much more likely to learn more from someone who I read and go, ooh, that wasn't good. So I do, and I'm not really worried about being influenced by them. I mean, worried about it. I don't think I can imitate someone else. I'm not that good. I don't know. I just don't. That's not a fear that I have. So I do. I read all kinds of fiction.
In closing, and those of us who will be at Literary Orange on Saturday, we'll get to hear more from you. But in closing today, do you have any advice for the writers, for the novelists who are listening?
I just think it's that, you know, don't expect it to be a fun, wee roller coaster ride. because I think that people who want to, who think they've got a book in them, and probably do, get discouraged by the fact that it's awfully hard work. And I think they can feel like, gee, I must not be very good because this is really hard. My message is to them, it is really hard. It's hard for everyone. I'm on my eighth novel. It's still hard. It never gets easier. It only gets easier in the sense that I know what this routine is. I know what my process is, but it's still hard, and there are days when it feels like I'm breaking rocks and I don't know what the next line should be, and I hate everything I've written and I want to go back and rip everything up. And those days I have understood and talked to other authors now and understood that this is true for all of them, whether they've been writing for 2 months or 20 years. So don't get discouraged. Just know that this is not easy, but it is ultimately fulfilling, and the moments of joy are well worth all the moments of misery.
Mm. Well, Marcia, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That was Marcia Clark. Her latest books are Blood Defense and Moral Defense. And as I said, she will be one of the keynote speakers this coming Saturday at Literary Orange. That is a Orange County Public Library event. It's going to be held at the Marriott in Newport Beach. I'll be moderating a fiction panel with Jade Chang, Kim Hooper, and Natasha Dion. And I think she's the first keynote, so get there early if you are going. It is sold out, I believe, but there's a waiting list. So if you get in touch with Literary Orange, you can get on that waiting list. It's a great event that happens every year. That's it for now. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this entire hour, and we'll see you here next week.